Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
How long the heavy bombardment of Gaza continues probably depends on how much pressure is put on Israel by allies. And by allies, I mean the US. Joe Biden himself is under pressure from quite a surprising constituency, Gen Z voters. A new poll for the New York Times suggests a full three quarters of 18 to 29-year-olds don't support Biden's stance on the war, his support for Israel. Oddly, many are turning to Trump instead, despite being left-leaning. In July, American Gen Z voters backed Biden over Trump by 10 percentage points, but now, 10 weeks into this conflict, Trump leads among young people by 49 to 43%. Interestingly, those who use TikTok regularly were the most critical of Biden. So what is happening? One of our Gen Z colleagues has been on the case. You're listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Luke Jones. Today, what Gen Z thinks about Israel and Gaza.
I'm Katie Tarrant, and I'm a news reporter for The Sunday Times.
And you're 62, is that right?
The wisdom of a 62-year-old, I like to think.
Okay. But you're actually, what are you? Are you millennial or are you a Gen Zer?
I am actually a Gen Zer. I'm 25, so I'm at the sort of upper end of the Gen Z spectrum.
A sort of geriatric Gen Zer.
Exactly.
We're going to be talking about, well, concerns about anti-Semitism and where people your age sit in the debate about what's happening in Gaza and Israel. Interestingly, the sort of latest wave of this started after a big stooshy in some elite American universities. Explain what happened there.
As we've seen in the UK, in London, every Saturday, you've had protests on university campuses, which tend to be generally quite pro-Palestinian. And at these protests, again, as you've heard in the UK, there were chants of intifada,
intifada, intifada,
chants of from the river to the sea,
from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
When we say we want Palestine to be free, it's from the river to the sea.
Which, you know, some people use that phrase in terms of freeing the Palestinian people, but it also can be interpreted as calling for the genocide of the Jewish population of Israel.
Hmm.
As a result of that, donors for these big universities in the US, Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, MIT, the donors for these universities started writing to the college presidents saying, we're concerned about anti-Semitism on your campuses. What are you going to do about it? After that, Congress got involved and pulled these presidents into a congressional hearing where they were grilled on whether they were doing enough to combat anti-Semitism.
And I'm not usually across congressional hearings, to be honest, but I did see a bit of that because there was a specific moment that went somewhat viral.
Mm.
I am asking, specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
One of those presidents, Liz McGill of the University of Pennsylvania, was asked directly if calling for a genocide of the Jews would violate the university policies. And she said,
if it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So the answer is yes.
It is a context-dependent decision, Congresswoman.
A context-dependent decision.
Which didn't go down well.
It's a context-dependent decision. That's your testimony today. Calling for the genocide of Jews is depending upon the context. That is not bullying or harassment. This is the easiest question to answer yes, Ms. McGill.
So after the hearing, she posted an apology video.
In that moment, I was focused on our university's longstanding policies aligned with the U.S. Constitution, which say that speech alone is not punishable. I was not focused on, but I should have been, the irrefutable fact that a call for genocide of Jewish people is a call for some of the most terrible violence human beings can perpetrate.
But that was it for her, and she had to resign. And the other two also faced calls for their resignations, but their universities backed them.
Outside of Congress and elsewhere, there was also a bit of a panic over what some TikTokers were saying about Bin Laden. Is that right?
Yeah, so there were videos citing a document that Bin Laden had written in 2002. It was called The Letter to America.
So I just read A Letter to America, and I will never look at life the same. I will never look at this country the same.
The Observer published that, and it looked like a comment piece on their website. Within this letter, alongside justifying 9/11, Bin Laden speaks about the occupation of Palestine and the need to free Palestinians from their shackles. And some TikTokers found this and shared it.
It's literally two pages. Go read A Letter to America. And please come back here and just let me know what you think.
It explains so much. Whew, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Suddenly, this became what looked like a lot of Gen Zers endorsing Bin Laden and sort of everything he represents because he'd made this comment about Palestine.
In reading the letter, I could only think of this tweet that I saw the other day. Under settler colonialism, any kind of resistance is branded as terrorist because the only acceptable violence is violence by the occupier.
I feel like I'm going through like an existential crisis right now, and a lot of people are.
Reading this letter, it becomes apparent to me that the actions of 9/11 and those acts committed against the USA and its people were all just the buildup of our government failing other nations.
But the interesting thing about this is actually videos citing the document had been viewed far less than many TikTok posts. So the first user to post about the letter was a TikTok user with only 371 followers. It didn't actually rank among TikTok's top trends, but then a journalist made a compilation of all of the videos and posted it to X, and that sort of caused it to explode. When this journalist shared the video, it was then viewed more than 38 million times. So it's kind of important to get a sense of proportionality when we're discussing what happened with this. And another thing that didn't help was that The Guardian pulled the letter from its website, which accidentally amplified it and brought in the idea of a conspiracy around the letter.
Incredible. So you've got concerns that some Gen Zers are
pro-Bin Laden, I can't believe I'm saying that, in the context of this debate. You've got some on university campuses calling for another intifada, or, you know, using chants of from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which, you know, many Jews see as a sort of threat of ethnic cleansing. Do we know how representative that is of the Gen Z cohort?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I feel slightly uncomfortable talking about an entire generation sort of point of view, but we do have polling. There have been several polls over the last couple of months that have suggested that Gen Z are pro-Palestinian. So there was a YouGov poll for the Sunday Times at the start of November. Among the 18 to 24 age group, 37% would say that they sympathise more with the Palestinian side, compared with only 13% who would say the Israeli side. 17% say they sympathise with both sides equally. 34% said that they didn't know. When you look at the over 65s, the numbers are almost exactly the opposite. So you've got 12% would say that they support the Palestinians versus 30% saying they'd sympathise more with the Israelis. But I mean, it's important to remember that the poll also found that just because you felt more strongly about one side doesn't mean that you couldn't sympathise with the other side as well. But then there was a recent poll by this group called More in Common, which was an organisation set up in the aftermath of the murder of Joe Cox MP. That poll in particular looked at what terms Gen Z would use to describe Hamas. So 24% said that they would call Hamas freedom fighters, and the same proportion would call them terrorists. So, I mean, that just shows you that there's a split in opinion.
Was the proportion of people saying that Hamas were freedom fighters greater than the same in other generational cohorts?
The poll didn't specifically look at this across other age groups, but from other research I've seen, yes, this is Gen Z are tend to be more pro-Palestinian.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how many of these things have become slogans, especially on marches, whether it's, you know, in the centre of big cities or on university campuses. Things like from the river to the sea, many people interpret that in different way, but are we sure that some of the people chanting this appreciate that, know necessarily what they're saying in some instances?
So, yeah, there's a professor at UC Berkeley called Ron Hassner. He hired a firm to poll 250 students across the US. Now, 86% of those students said that they supported the chant, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. But when they were asked which river and which sea, 53% of them got it wrong. Some alternatives to this included answers like the Nile and the Caribbean and the Dead Sea, which is a lake. Hasner asked a few other questions as well. So what decade Israelis and Palestinians had signed the Oslo Accords, and more than a quarter of the chant supporters claimed that no such peace agreements had ever been signed. He also claims that students changed their mind about from the river to the sea when they were shown a map and told some information about the region. And I do think, in my generation's defence, it's not something that's widely taught in schools. And it is a big trait of this generation to want to educate yourself in topics that you don't know about. So I'd say this is probably the best educated generation on the colonisation of African countries, for example. So I think it just really speaks to this idea that when you're getting your clips on TikTok, which are, you know, explaining a little bit about the Balfour Declaration or showing you a map of Israel, are they really doing the job that education should be doing?
So if that's a kind of broad brush look at what many Gen Zers think about this conflict and this knotty issue, there's then the question of why. And you've been speaking to some people who have various different theories. What are some of the theories that you've heard?
Yeah, so I mean, I touched upon it briefly there, but I think theory number one is that Gen Z are predominantly pro-Palestinian because of what they see on TikTok. The second is that they lean left, and the left, at least in the sort of last 20 years, tends to be quite pro-Palestine in its sympathies. And the third is that it fits into this generational belief framework that Gen Z has, that it's anti-Western imperialism. And the sort of interpretation that this generation has of Israel as an aggressive colonialist state.
Coming up, do any of these theories actually hold water? We will hear Katie Tarrant's conversations with some experts. That's in a moment.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
So let's get into some of the theories that people have given you as to why Gen Zers are maybe more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause than the Israeli side of things. Can we sort of go the wrong way around? And the last one you mentioned, let's start with that. The idea that being pro-Palestinian for Generation Zers fits into a framework of things that they already believe in, and it sort of comes as a package. I mean, it's a, well, if I'm a feminist and a sort of anti-racist, it's sort of what goes with that. What the sort of thing that it jigsaws into it is pro-Palestinian. Intersectionality is the word that people use, isn't it?
Mm, exactly. So I spoke to a contemporary historian called Dr. Martin Farr.
Yes, Dr. Martin Farr, senior lecturer in contemporary British history at Newcastle University. The current bunch of students didn't have an attitude towards Palestine. They probably didn't know about it, really, even political students, unless they were studying Middle East politics, which isn't really done at school. They wouldn't have known about this as an issue before 7th of October. And then suddenly they think, well, what is this? Who knew about this?
His point of view is that people are driven by sort of very emotive and straightforward issues. And the idea of Britain's role in the founding of Israel and the Balfour Declaration as this moment of British colonialism has been shared multiple times on TikTok.
Britain has a role in this, particularly with the Balfour Declaration 1917, Britain encouraging a state in Palestine and then facilitating it after the war and then backing Israel throughout. But the motivations then were partly Zionist in the sense of wanting a homeland for the Jews, but also partly anti-Semitic because they wanted them there rather than here. And then after the war, you get the enormous moral cause of the Holocaust, the experience of the Shoah, which not only encourages Jews from Europe to go to Israel, but also facilitates the desire of the West to support the state of Israel. After 67 and the growth of settlements in the West Bank, it clearly is settler colonialism to an extent, but many Israelis and certainly Orthodox Jews would see this as being a biblical inheritance rather than one imposed by Western powers. The Labour Party had historically been quite pro-Israel because it had Israel as an idealistic notion in this region, democracy, women's rights, kibbutzim, you know, collective experience and sharing things. So the Labour Party had a strong tradition of that, Zionists. Harold Wilson was a Zionist. Conservative Party, curiously, historically tended to have more anti-Semites in it because they tended to associate Israel with Bolshevism and communism. But it switched in the 80s because you had the Cold War and because you had shared enemies and you had us becoming much more aligned with American foreign policy thinking as well.
But then he explained that you could trace this shift in opinion to the Yom Kippur War in 1973.
Students 50 years ago, this was a cause. The 67 war, the Six-Day War, was an enormous cause because both that and the 73 war can be seen as attacks on Israel and Israel defending itself, but can equally be interpreted, at least in its consequences, as Israel being a dominating colonial power in the region.
And so that started to shift opinion in the 70s and 80s.
And in the 70s and 80s, it was crystallized because you had apartheid as an enormously motivating, South Africa, enormously motivating factor for many undergraduates. It was for me, actually. And then Palestine became more and more of a cause in the 70s and 80s, particularly with the 82 invasion of Lebanon and Israel being seen as an aggressive power. Israel had gone from being David to being Goliath. By and large, I did ask for a show of hands in the lecture, and one person had pro-Israeli sympathies and everybody else was pro-Palestine, as expected, because the evidence they have is of Israel as an aggressor and an aggressor supported by the West. They see the footage because although there's lots of footage of the Hamas attack, there's much more footage because it's been more prolonged of Israel's response in Gaza. And that's very emotive. So the ones who were political in the first place, this is reinforcing their views about Palestine as an issue and Western imperialism and anti-Americanism, which a partial view of the conflict would allow them to have, but it is partial. I've been to events, pro-Palestine events, as well also pro-Israeli events, and in the pro-Palestine events, that it's not even mentioned. 7th of October isn't even mentioned.
And I think part of this theory as well is that this generation didn't grow up with certain events in living memory. So, for example, Arafat rejecting a peace deal offered to him in 2000 at Camp David, or the suicide attacks during the Intifadas. And obviously, October 7th has happened very much within their living memory. But one poll in America actually found that 18% of adults didn't believe that the October 7th event even happened. So there is also this level of disinformation that's going on, that it just depends what they're consuming in terms of what they're going to feel most strongly about.
And of course, the exposure they had. I mean, when I was studying the Intifada and Rabin and the Oslo Accords and Clinton in '93, you had with newspapers and linear news and nothing else really. So the exposure they have to news is unlimited. But also, they're not used to legacy news providers and properly edited and curated and commissioned news content. I've just been speaking to some outside. I mean, it is just Instagram and TikTok. Which that wasn't the case 5 years ago. So it's a remarkably transformative, I mean, media always is. There are new platforms, there are new moral panics about them. But the algorithmic dimension to this is not something we would ever have considered in 82 or with the first Intifada. This is a category difference in terms of what this means to observers far away and what type of news coverage can be conveyed.
It's interesting, isn't it, that one of the problems, if it is a problem, of TikTok and Instagram Reels and the rest is that you're basically served up things it knows you already like. So it just sends you further down, you know, whatever viewpoint you have. And I guess in this debate, if you've got people who are constantly seeing, I don't know, Black Lives Matter thing, that might immediately then give them sort of pro-Palestinian stuff. And if you're seeing conservative media stuff, you end up then being given pro-Israeli stuff as almost as a default.
The videos that make the money are those that are just visceral and emotive, and they drive people to feel something. When you feel something, you're going to keep scrolling, you're going to keep engaging with the app.
And I guess in that environment, that's where you lose all nuance.
Absolutely. And there are sort of anti-Semitic tropes that have been allowed to proliferate for years. And so the generation that's been watching this for years and years might have some of these ideas subliminally in mind.
And does part of the political skew happen because of the number of people of different persuasions actually posting on these platforms? Like, is it the case that there are just more people from the pro-Palestinian side of things who use TikTok and Twitter, and that's why you see more of that content on those platforms?
The Times spoke to an analyst who found that on platforms like TikTok, for every one pro-Israeli video watch, there were 65 pro-Palestinian videos. TikTok is notoriously secretive about their algorithms. But I mean, just being able to see that, you know, hashtag Free Palestine was used 39 times more than the hashtags I Stand With Israel was used, for example, sort of shows what people are wanting from that app.
And some people might be hearing this and thinking, this is just people who maybe would have thought these things anyway, posting it to maybe little consequence on the internet. I mean, but do we have a sense of actually how consequential this is?
Well, that's one of the most fascinating questions for me. So I spoke with a journalist called David Patrikarakos.
I'm David Patrikarakos, and I write for various newspapers in Britain and America. My book, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century, deals with many of the issues that are quite relevant today, I think, especially around Israel and Gaza.
His perception on this is actually that the sort of information war, as he calls it, is even more significant than battlefield conflict.
I first started covering this in 2014 when I entered Ukraine. What I saw in eastern Ukraine was something that I'd never seen before. I saw, to put it very simply, two wars playing out. One on the ground with tanks and guns and bullets, and the other being fought out online with tweets and posts and shares. And what really struck me at that point, before, I must add, the 2022 all-out invasion of Ukraine by Russia, I saw military operations on the ground supporting information operations online and in cyberspace, which is a reversal of the way things are traditionally in war. Let's not forget propaganda is as old as war itself. But I saw essentially a war being carried out for political, not military ends. For information, the primary conduit of which was social media, especially for younger generations.
And the reason that this is so interesting is that what becomes important is how long Israel can justify the use of military action in Gaza.
When we strip away all the sound and the noise, any military battle between Hamas and Israel is predetermined before it starts. In the end, Hamas is not going to drive all the Jews into the sea, and Israel is not going to be able to wipe out all of Hamas. Israel is a small country. It's a powerful country. But it's a small state. It needs international support. It needs a US cover in the Security Council to put its veto in. Now, if Israel cannot justify why it fights, things become very problematic. Hamas knows that it cannot wipe out the Israeli army. So what is its strategy? Its strategy is you goad the Israeli army in. And because you cannot brandish so many corpses of Israeli soldiers to the world, you brandish your own corpses of your own Gazan dead. Every single Gazan child, every single Gazan man and woman is a tragedy. But if we're talking about the political calculation here, it's yet more pressure on Israel. The more those bodies are shown to the world, the harder it becomes for Israel. This is the paradoxical logic of strategy, in a sense. The more Hamas loses and suffers, the more Gaza is destroyed. Politically, the pressure grows on Israel. And this is vital to Hamas because it's the only leverage in the end that it has. So in a war like Hamas and Israel, where the military outcome is predetermined, this is the way that Hamas can win. And for that, especially when you're talking about the younger generation, platforms like TikTok especially are absolutely critical.
And that's where, if you have a vocal generation who the sort of videos they're seeing make them very against what Israel is doing, but what it says it's doing to defend itself, that becomes a problem for politicians like Biden.
Yes. So actually that pressure from the online world can even exert some kind of influence even on people like President Biden, who I don't think is on TikTok much.
No, I assume he's probably not, but
a TikToker in themselves doesn't have influence. But when you get large parts of your population who are watching these videos becoming outraged, there is internal pressure, right? Joe Biden will be feeling internal pressure from sections of the American Congress and certainly from, you know, protests and stuff he'll see in the street. So it's not immediate pressure in the way that politicians talk to each other, but it does matter, right? You know, in democracies, people are, in the end, as flawed as they are, accountable to their electorates. I speak to IDF people, and they understand that the window that they have is not a long one because of this sort of stuff.
Do you see the sort of two things that we've discussed fueling each other, the nature of social media and the kind of debate that's been happening on university campuses in the UK and in the US as well? Is it a sort of cycle that actually strengthens each side?
The interesting thing David was saying as well is,
but 25 years ago, you'd watch the BBC or you'd read the Sunday Times. Now, you'd watch footage coming out of this conflict that was professionally filmed, curated, edited, reported. There would, you assume, be checks and balances there. Now, that pro-Israeli supporter, that pro-Palestinian supporter would see the same footage. Now, they might draw their own conclusions from it, but they saw the same thing. So they were at least working from the same reality. If you go onto pro-Israeli accounts and pro-Palestinian accounts, they are light years different. light years. You are not seeing this war. You are seeing one side of it. And the thing is, if you and I, if we watch the same footage, we can have a conversation. If you see only what you see and I see only what I see, conversation becomes difficult because if we watch the same footage, I say, no, I disagree with this. If we see something totally different, it's like, well, you're a liar. That didn't happen because I've seen it, I've heard it, I've read it, and you're a liar, and it becomes worse. And look, you know, I see people, a lot of people denying 7th of October. I've seen people denying that they're Hamas tunnels, even though Hamas talks about them, and even though hostages are kept in the tunnels. And that's very, very dangerous. If we cannot have a conversation from the same reality, if my opponent becomes a liar, a terrorist, or a fascist, then this is obviously very deleterious for the public sphere and for any kind of resolution around these issues.
Where do you see this going next, Katie? Does this moment mean that these are views that Gen Z will hold for the rest of their lives?
So it's a good question in terms of whether this generation will continue to have these views as they grow older. I mean, when it comes to working out what you think about the world, these are really formative years, but I guess only time will tell. I think what's important to consider as well is it matters what happens in Israel. If Netanyahu were to step down from government or be deposed from government, you know, Netanyahu has seen protests in his own country from his own Generation Z. The situation now is that Israel is relying on support from the US, which is waning. And I guess the question is, what happens in 20 or 30 years' time when these people become the majority of voters? How is that going to influence the US's foreign policy and attitudes towards Israel?
You've been listening to Stories of Our Times, a podcast brought to you thanks to subscribers of The Times and The Sunday Times, with me, Luke Jones, and my guest, Sunday Times news reporter Katie Tarrant. The producer today was James Shield, and the executive producer was Fiona Leach. Goodbye.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.